people. Oh, Mav Blatt. Hello, Mav, how are you? Sat Mav.
Satmav here,
Sat
sounded
Mav, sorry,
great.
yes. Funny enough, we were talking about you just before. Anita Plummer. You'll probably recognise these, Mav, won't you? Yeah. The dripping tap. I've got the joy of repairing a dripping tap shortly. Your rag pudding. What the hell's a rag
It's
pudding?
either black pudding or rice pudding, but we've got a typo.
Yeah, a bit of a t slow down on your typing, Mav. Yes, questions tonight. I said if you do ask a question, if there might be a sh short delay before it comes up on the screen or I get a chance to answer it. It's looking like it's just me and you at the moment, Mav, so I should just pick up the phone and have a gas to you, but hey, we're trying this and we'll see how it goes. Brexit, yeah, what's all about
Stop
Brexit?
it. I told you to keep off Brexit.
I know politics, including Brexit, sex, and religion, apparently we have to steer clear with, plus marriage relations as well. Should have taken part before you bought them so you can get the correct one. I'm going to guess.
We
Apparently,
daren't take the bloody tap apart in case it explodes in some sort of water fountain.
it's never been apart for 30 years. In fact, I don't think it's been apart since it was installed. So. Apparently, the person at B&Q, which is a place of excellence I went to, said that it's either going to be a 3/8, half inch, or 3/4, and hence that's what these are apparently. So we'll see. If it's right, it's right. If it's wrong, it's bloody wrong. Oh, suet. Oh, very nice. I hope it was a really, really hot custard with it as well. There's a bit of a quiz. Who can tell me what year this was? It was France, and they were holding, I think, the World Cup. I'm not a footballer, no idea. But it's one of my favourite mugs.
Why is it one of your favourite mugs?
It's just got the right sort of. I don't know, it's like a wine glass. Some wine glasses give you a better taste, don't they? I don't know quite how of it. 98. I think you're right, Mav. I haven't got my right glasses on. Hang on. Put my Dr. Death's on so I can see the job. Yeah, 98. Well held.
Football, does he?
He must do. I never said he was perfect. Right, come on, Mav, questions. Let's get a question going. Can be about anything at all. How's your bricking gone on? How's that your garages? Have they got it up yet? And I hope you didn't mind me having a little bit of a dig at the scaffolding. After I pressed go on the thing, I felt a bit guilty for about 5 seconds, and then I kind of washed over it. But yeah, it looked good. Looks good so far. They must be close to the roof level by now. Don't know. Don't know. I have my drawing board here as well, so if people want to see me draw cartoons or whatever, I can do stuff like that. But hopefully, it'll be more about angles going into corners and breaking angles and stuff like that. Who's up there? Oh, Giovanni reckons he's coming on.
Oh, Matt's Thursday evening. All he's had to do a bit of work on the road bike is replace the seals on the forks. He needs to get some food cooking, but we'll have you on in the background.
All right. Well, good evening, Matt. I hope you're well.
Has
How's
he
your
got his tank
I was going to say,
extender on yet?
how's your tank extender on? We were talking about that the other evening, tank extenders,
Mav knows all about it.
I know he needs a tank extension, does Mav, and he's a certain
Mostly from
extension of some sort.
Mark in Jersey.
I know that, I know that. But no, we didn't quite know how to get around that. I'm still not. I was talking to Simon Crafer about this, about positioning the saddle. Now, Simon's quite a tall unit. And he loves in the braking area being right up against the tank. And his theory is it takes weight off your arms because you can hold yourself in better. And I suppose in a sense that's what the tank extension's back is, allows you to slide up to not as far as it normally is. But on the standard Suzuki tanks, it's quite close to the headstock. So I mean, if it works for him, I suppose you just have to get used to it at the end of the day. Who knows? Oh, I didn't slide down there. Sorry, everybody, I've not been using my machine properly. Okay. Right. What's Matt's doing? Oh, he's working, replacing the fork seals, Matt. Oh, that's a big one. Are you doing it yourself, the fork seals? Because it's not a 2-minute job, that. I used to hate doing it because, like, you get like a tiny drop of oil, it end up absolutely bloody everywhere. And don't use the same oil for the cooking. It's not a good route way out of it, really, to be fair. What else are you doing at the moment, Matt? You're going to have to sort of talk to me about
it
something.
It says here that Mav says that'll be a disaster if Matt's working on the brakes. But Matt said he was doing the forks, not the brakes.
Right. I don't know. I don't know why it'll be a disaster. He knows what he's up to. You know what you're up to there, Matt. I'm sure by now.
Paul first getting fit. He's getting motivated for his first mini twin ride. He's not boozing anymore. He's going to slurp green tea, snack on fish and chicken breasts. I'm joking.
Oh, don't do it to yourself. Bloody hell, Paul. In 1991, I joined a gym, and it's the only time I'd ever been in a gym as such, because I was riding a superbike for Tilston's of Stockton, OW1. They put a lot of money into the bike and that, and it was a good thing. So I thought, right, I've got to get fit. Everyone was going to gyms, so I joined this gym, and I went for about 3 months, roughly 3 months. And give it up. It was absolutely killing me. I thought there's no point in this at all. I was absolutely bollocksed all the time and not enjoying it either. So I thought, leave that alone. So yeah, jogging. Now, the best exercise, I think, which is feasible, is riding the bike. But of course, if you can't ride the bike all the time, so I suppose you have to turn your hand to something. My mother-in-law bought me a rowing machine, and that's collecting dust in the cellar as we speak. But about 2014, something like that, I was riding the 848 in the Ducati series and fell off and broke two vertebrae in my back, or compressed them, and had to get fit quickly. And the doctor says no, running, because they didn't want to that jar in the bones. So I did a lot of swimming, and the swimming was fantastic. But the ball ache of swimming, of course, is you have to go somewhere, get undressed, get in the water, go through the motions and get out. So it absorbs a lot of time. But I was mega fit then, I really was.
Swam a mile, didn't you?
Yeah, I was a lean, mean fighting machine
at
that point.
And how did you count the laps, can you remember?
Yeah, I used to do lengths, and I used to try and get up to about 100 lengths. And what I used to do to try and remember them was think of motorcycle racers who used to race with standardised numbers. You know, like Barry Sheen would be 7, Ron Asloughton was number 10, and 46, of course, we know who that is, and loads in between. And it would keep me alert, as it were, thinking about what numbers were what.
Yes, you're definitely alert, dear. Mav wants to know, what's your take on adjustable triple clamps? Not nipple clamps, triple clamps.
Nipple clamps. What's your take on adjustable triple clamps? I'm assuming what you're talking about there is altering the angle of the forks. Is that what you're thinking about? That's all I can actually think about. The only thing, the problem with that is it's a cheat's way of doing it, because it doesn't it alters the angle of the fork, but the road when the wheel turns, or the yokes turn, it's not the true rotation of the actual steering stem. So it's kind of a cheat's way of doing it. Ultimately, you need to get the headstock to get it to, you know, you can put elliptical cups in that. That's the best way of doing it. But even then, to be fair, I would say 95% of riders is you could alter it 2 or 3 degrees one way or the other, and it'd be really difficult to tell. It's like altering one click on the suspension. It's a tough ask. You have to go sort of 2 or 3 degrees one way or the other to get any advantage. And to be fair, the average, let's say if it's a super bike you're altering, a stock sport bike, something like that, the average bike are pretty much on the money as it is. And to be fair, also altering the ride height and dropping the fork effectively alters the fork angle as well. Adjustments in the suspension and setup. But to be fair, the stock bike there, they look fabulous and they're all trick and bollocksy. I don't know, it's like these people who put quick detachable connectors on the calipers. I mean, what's all that about?
It's bling. Has it gotten to go with
Yeah, that fancy gearbox. Fancy gearbox as it pops out the side of the motor. No, it won't. It won't. It'd be great. But actually, Mav.
Ridden a bike where you adjusted the angle of the headstock mid-season or what bike would that you do that on?
That was the one bike I can remember riding where we did a lot of buggering about with that was the Phase One Kawasaki back in 93, 4, something like that. They were sodding about with trying to make that work, and they kind of lost the way a little bit with it because it makes a huge difference. And sometimes you can jump past what is the ultimate setting. And like anything, you have to do a lot of testing with just one thing, as opposed to, ride around for say 5 and then move on to the next thing. You've got to go through a range of it with each step. And the problem back in them days was invariably you were short on track time anyway, and they were trying to do too many things at once, and that's the cardinal sin, is you never go out on track with two things that you've changed, because which is altered which, and one might cancel the other out. But the Kawasaki, that was a long time ago, but that was the last one I can remember where we did a lot of work with it. But I've ridden other bikes where we've made a quick change. I rode a Suzuki 450. It's like a motocross bike but turned into a racer, and we messed about there quite a lot with the headstock as well. Trying to do is trying to make it steer, which it did ultimately, but we were trying to, believe it or not, cure rear patter, and we were trying absolutely everything trying to stop this rear patter. And it turned out in the end what cured it was actually something as simple as tire pressure. We dropped the tire pressure, the back tire pressure, down dramatically, and it went away. So it's weird. There's some of the things which you end up changing, which have quite a big knock-on effect with something else.
We draw something on the board, like the angle of the forks relative to speed of turning in or
No,
slow turning in.
it's that's a really, really complicated issue, that, to be fair.
Do I get a drawing on my board today?
I can draw a but drawing something on there, yeah, at some point. Give us something to draw, and don't say angles of headstock and that, because you can. It's a really simple way of thinking it. If you can picture front wheel, back wheel, swinging arm going to a pivot point, you've got your forks going up to a pivot point there, which is your headstock, and obviously the frame. What the adjustable headstock do is effectively tilt in the fork, make the fork a little bit steeper, which alters the rake and trail. And things like that. But if you can imagine, if you lift the back of the bike up by altering the ride height, effectively you steepen the angle up anyway. So usually with a combination of altering the height of the bike, you can effectively have a very similar effect to that. It's not actually like that, but that's kind of roughly the way it works.
Right, so Paul first asked a question now. He obviously doesn't know your history because he said, would you have liked to race the Daytona 200? And if so, on what bike?
Right.
Preferably not a Harley Davidson that you crash on and break your collarbone.
There's a lump on my shoulder, you can't really see it very well, was the infield corner, which leads up onto the first banking at Daytona. Yes, I have done Daytona in 1995, and I did it on a Harley VR1000, which was supposed to be the dog's bollocks new superbike at the time. And what a lemon it was. Handled lovely and stopped well, but just it had, when we finished the project at the end of the year, it had 122 horsepower, which was 45 horsepower down on a 750. And it wasn't light either, so it was absolutely like trying to shovel water uphill. It was bloody hard work. And I was trying to, funny enough, when I crashed, I'd blown the motor up in practice, because we'd gone up, went over there, and the Harley people had said, right, we're going to up bit about with it, and we missed the practice session. So they give us another engine, and we're running out of time ultimately. Race broke down. This is a twins race. So the main 200 practice, I was qualifying in the main 200 practice, and I qualified was in the first. Amazing considering, because when you go up on the banking, it's 35 degrees. It's incredibly steep. You can't believe it. So you go up onto the banking and you go faster and faster and faster. And the real quick lads go right to the top and stay around the top. And then the time when they come down off the banking onto the straights again, which is level or almost level, the time that run down, if you stay wide, effectively you don't get the same acceleration off the banking. So it's all about timing the run down there. So it sounds very simple, but it's quite a technical circuit to actually get right. But the problem is you needed a shitload of power to stay at the top of the banking, otherwise you sort of fell down. You'd almost have to turn to go up the banking, which is counterproductive. So I was halfway around the banking trying to stay. Anyway, infield section. And just as I come out of the infield section, not a name dropping, but Freddie Spencer went past on a Fastby Ferracci
Fast by Ferracci, I remember them.
Ducati. And I thought, right, perfect toe here. Last thing I remember, the next thing was, oh dear, crunch ballup. And the thing ended up in a ball of fire. Best thing which could have happened to it. Then the irony was, three Brits fell off at the same corner. Roger Bennett, me, and Ian Duffus. And we all broke our left collarbone. So I was in good company, all in the same hospital. Good fun.
I think Roger had an overnight stay and was several thousand dollars lighter though when he came out, wasn't
Yes,
he?
he got. His bill was 20 then. This is 1995. $22,000. His bill was. He was absolutely crying. Thankfully, he was one of the few people, because Roger's a sensible soul, and he took out insurance. And
Roger
none of the
Bennett.
others lot did. So we sort of limped out with an injection and a thing on, and that was $600. A nightmare.
Right, Satmav says, do you think Rossi will be competitive on the satellite bike? Or do you think it's more that his arm's being twisted and it's a PR thing for him to stay in the paddock as he's the big ticket drum?
Yeah, the short answer is, I think Rossi, even though he's a fantastic rider, etc., I think his day is run. Ultimately, he'll run with the pack and he'll be there or thereabouts. But his days of regularly being on the top three rostrums, I think, are realistically over. Because he is such a draw with the crowd. The organisation will want him there, so they will make sure he has a bike of some sort. But honestly, feel he's at his day, because there's some strong riders, young riders.
Is it because they're riding differently?
Well, they all are now. They've all adapted a sort of a newer style. The older style's kind of fizzled out a little bit. But yes, they've all kind of moved on. Everything's moved on. The bikes have moved on. And I think, in the nicest way, don't get me wrong, there's nothing more I would love to see is Valley winning a race. It would just be absolutely amazing. But I think it would be a particular track on a particular day with a particular range of situations, and he just ends up kind of at the front and takes the win. That would suit me. And to be honest, I think if he did, he'd probably retire on the spot. Woohoo, done. Job done, tick. But no, to answer your question, yes, I wouldn't say he's had his arm twisted. At the end of the day, he's a very rich guy, but he's also commercially driven to keep on doing it. And to be fair,
I think he still likes riding
he still
bikes.
likes riding bikes, you know. So, you know, you might as well ride at a GP. You know, if I was a multimillionaire or even a millionaire, I would go and have a go. I'm totally realistic. I probably wouldn't even qualify, but it'd be just fantastic to go there and sort of do it, as it were. But in the same breath, I'm competitive still, and I like to be competitive. I like to. When you are competitive, should we say, you try and reduce the size of the pond that you swim in. So you tend to be still a big fish in the pond. You end up in a puddle, though. That's the problem with it. But never mind. Right, come on, other questions. Come on, Paul, you'll have a few.
So what was the best bit about Daytona?
Daytona.
Was it because it was in spring break and all the dolly birds were there?
Yeah, it was really weird. Daytona itself, the circuit's probably about 4 or 5 miles from Daytona Beach, which is a big thing, and it was then. The preceding week to spring break, which is a massive thing in the States. All the teenagers go fucking berserk, and obviously up and down the beach, and it's a bit like sort of Scarborough. It's quite got a nice big beach front, and then 200 yards inland from the beach, there's virtually nothing, or there wasn't then. But the road out of town was where the circuit is. Now you can imagine the circuit itself; it holds the NASCAR thing, and they have like seating capacity for something like 500,000 people. It's an amazing facility in many ways. And a load of bikers go there as well. And we were in town in a bar, and these bikers and said, "Hey, you're English. What are you doing here?" I said, "Oh, so we're racing at Daytona," and they said, "Oh, well, what's happening?" I said, "Oh, it's the Daytona 200 motorcycle race." And these were in brackets bikers, and they had no idea that there was racing on the circuit. So it's a weird culture thing in the States. Was then, may have
I
changed.
think they take the bikes on trailers as well. They
Oh,
don't even ride them there, do
yeah,
they?
the vast percentage of the bikers there, they were sort of white collar workers who enjoyed riding a motorcycle up and down the beach, probably to try and pull a chick. Then put the bike in the trailer and have it shipped home. But I think very few of them actually rode there.
Isn't there a corner called Harley Heaven or Hog Heaven or something? And nobody wants to fall off there because of all the abuse they get from the
Yeah,
rider now.
again, this we're talking 25 years ago, so it may have well changed. But there was a corner on the infield section which had a quite a large-ish temporary grandstand there, and it was called, I think it was called Hog's Heaven or something like that. This kind, it was like all Harley Davidson owners used to go there, and they'd have the little cooler box full of beers, and they'd go sit and they'd get pissed up and throw beer cans at the marshals. And
Sounds like Donington.
one of our friends fell off there or broke down there, Lee Pullen. And Lee, if you ever knew him, was absolutely so much fun. He was hard work sometimes, but fantastic fun. He either fell off or broke down there, and he was riding a Kawasaki, which didn't go down well with the Harley people, who were proper rednecks, sort of dyed in the wool Harley people, and they were giving him a load of shit about being on a Kawasaki, and Lee just ripped into him, and the banter was absolutely fantastic.
I think the Americans won those. Hey, buddy, if it wasn't for our granddaddies, you'd all be speaking
You'd all be
German.
speaking fucking German, yeah. It's quite. They had a point there with that one, really. But the weird thing about the track is it obviously has an infield section, you know, akin to sort of like the infield section of Snetterton, and then you've got a tri-oval, which is two big curves, and then the start finish line is on like a
Could you draw
fast
it for
kink.
me?
No. And the two big bankings, obviously it goes up to 35 degrees, and then the straights between the bankings are down to probably about 10 degrees, that there's a slight angle. But as I said, coming off the banking was the weird, but when you're on the banking, you're almost totally disorientated as to what's going on, because when you go up on the banking, you come off the infield and you kind of look at this wall of tarmac, and it's pretty intimidating. The first time you do it, you go straight to the top and straight to the bottom again. It does shit you up a bit. Once you get used to the idea, and if you have enough power, you hang on to the wall, and you hug the wall all the way around. And you can imagine it, say at Rockingham, for instance, if anyone did Rockingham, it's a similar thing there. But going down the start finish straight at sort of 180, 190 mile an hour with the wall like 2 feet away from you, it certainly gives a different sensation. But the weird thing, because you're on this banking and it's at 35 degrees, you're being pushed into the banking, so the suspension is almost bottomed out, and if you've got your chin more or less on the tank, and you can barely lift your head up off the tank because you've been, it's like being constantly in a depression, you know, when you go down a dip in the road, it's like all the way around the banking, and you're actually, even though you're effectively going in a straight line, you're not, you don't realize it, but you've got a little bit of turning because you're going around a long left, and you're actually looking left all the time hand side of the screen, and then you come off the banking and it's like all your world goes all strange. It's like, as I think it kind of levels out again. A very unique experience. And
anyway, asked about Daytona, says, do you have any plans to test ride the new 660, the new Aprilia RS 660 when lockdown ends? Did you, I think we were looking at it.
It's one of the few bikes, Paul, which really pushes me buttons at the minute, to be fair. Modern superbikes are fantastic. They really blow your wind up your skirt and so on and so forth. But it's the hard work to ride. Everything's fucking full on. And these bikes, I think, if enough manufacturers get on board and keep this sort of mid-capacity class going, and make them, you know, juice them up a bit like this bike, it looks the bollocks. And they're doing a factory version as well, so it'll have proper suspension and all the rest of it, and traction control and blah, blah, blah. So it'll have all the toys with it, but won't scare the pants off you as much. So that will improve your riding because you'll actually, I think, ride it or ride harder, faster. But it's one of the few bikes, but I don't ride on the road. So me going for a ride on the road wouldn't prove anything because I would get nowhere near the bike's potential. And I'm certainly not going to ride one on the road. If I get the chance, I'll track day one.
So Nat says that he was talking to you about his test ride the other day.
Oh yes, yeah. You said it was pretty good, Nat. Yeah, that's some feedback. If you want to stick some comments on there about what your thoughts were, but yeah, you raved about it. I think it's the way to go. Ultimately,
a small capacity bike.
I mean, Kramer, for instance, and I mentioned Kramer's to you, Nat. I think Kramer do an 890 version of their chassis. 890 KTM engine, 130 horsepower, 130 kilos, tremendous power to weight ratio. That would be a formidable beast around any track. Obviously, a big long straight site, Silverstone, you'd be struggling a wee bit, but everywhere else, I think you'd show a pair of heels. Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, Mav now says, can you always analyze a crash? Or as with me, most crashes, I lie in the gravel and think, how on earth did that happen?
Yeah.
And you'd love to learn from them. It's just that it happens so quick. So how do you analyse, or can you always analyse a crash after it's happened?
If you're lucky, yes, Mav. There's a few things which can help. The build up to it, if you can remember, if you knock your head or you bang your head and stuff like that, it goes out the window. But usually there's a build up to a crash. If you've got data on the bike, you can sometimes tell, if you can download the data, you can see a critical point. And often if you overlay it with other data that you've got, you can sort of, you'll see something start to happen. But often in accidents, what ultimately causes them is, in many ways, overreaction. Things start to go wrong and then you tend to sort of panic. Let's say, for instance, you're going into the third corner at Brno, that sort of tightish left. No, the one I'm talking about, Matt. And when you're going into that, there's a little bump which can just unsettle the bike. And you even if you're going too fast at that sort of point, you've got to bin the brakes because that little, you might be hanging on where if there wasn't the bump there, you might have got away with it. But to analyse it, ultimately, you need to get to the bottom of a crash because, okay, it's happened, you can't do anything about it. But if you can figure out, okay, that happened because of that, I'm not going to do that again. But if you can't, or in a way, at the back of your generally speaking, you can break down crashes and come up with a solution at the end of the day.
And sometimes they're not always your fault, of course.
Of course.
Sometimes it's about taking evading action. Isn't it?
Yes, about taking evading action. Yeah, it's in fact, I was looking at a crash the other day. I can't say anything about it too much, but it was a weird crash where it was a culmination of factors. Very difficult to point the finger in any one direction. And if you'd have taken any of the people out involved, any of them, it wouldn't have happened. And it was, but it was really almost nobody's fault. It's very strange how
So it was
stuff
like a
like that happens.
sequence of events.
A sequence of events funneling down to a point, a critical mass, and then it all kind of went tits up, as it were.
So Peter's talking about the baggers. Do you remember watching the bagger racing from
Oh,
AMA?
I so want to go on one of them. What? That's proper racing. I mean, that would definitely, definitely, I'd love a go on that. You know, they'll be fully fettled motors, I would imagine, some of them. But like 200 and shitloads of kilos as well, which always makes it a bit lively. I mean, I would that,
All
definitely.
we need is the invite to America, a sort of... And I think you'd have to get the AMX. I don't know if there's an age limit. Do you think there's an age limit
No,
for bagger racing?
No, I think they'll let any old duffer on one of them. But no, definitely.
But some people were really drifting and went.
Oh, I mean, the front few, they're putting in some serious lap times. I mean, what's weird, I raced the Harley XR 1200 in the One Make Series in the UK a few years ago. And they were 220 kilos, something like that, race weight, 90, which isn't a great sum at the end of the day. But we put in some proper times on them, and they handle like tea trolleys. They weren't great things at all. But, you know, you sort of kept them steady. I remember Lee Gawley, you know, a good racer, very accomplished racer. He rode one as well. And we were at Oulton Park, and he crashed, I think, twice that weekend. And he says, the fucking thing's trying to kill me. And I tried to tell him or advise him. He was trying to really rive it and push the thing. And I says, you can't. It's going to do its own thing. I said, you've got to work with it. Let it sort of make its own mind up. A bit like dancing with a fat girl in a phone box. You've got to know exactly where to put your feet at the right point in time or things are going to go wrong. I mean, the baggers, I'd be well into that.
Another one who wanted to ride it as well was Glenn English, do you remember, at Cadwell Park?
Oh, yeah. Glenn rode my teammate who only did two races and then pulled out, Sean Emmett. He thought he was going to win it all and didn't. And then Glenn English had a go. You know, Glenn's a little tiny bloke, and he came up with the same conclusion, the fucking thing was trying to kill him. But again, Glenn is quite a fiery sort of rider and very interactive and throws himself around a lot. And it just didn't work with the bike at all. Again, a lot of them have the big wide handlebars on them, which people think is required to pull the bike about. But the problem is with the big handlebars is you end up putting lots of energy into the bike, which is usually too much, and it all kind of gets all away from you. I made my handlebars about 3 inches narrower. They were really narrow compared to a lot of other people's. And the handling for me was a vast improvement. But not for everybody.
And they were supposed to be stock bikes, the same for everyone, weren't they? And that was the one modification you made. But there was another rider who kept himself away from everyone else, and we couldn't see what.
Yeah,
he was
One Make Series are really good as long as everybody does the same sort of thing and doesn't bend the rules. And there was a couple of rule benders in it, and there was one particular rule bender whose name should not be mentioned.
Pat Drill.
Who ended up winning the championship, but there you go.
But of course, we never knew what he was up to because he was in a tent from everybody else.
The theory was we were all in one big awning, all kind of sharing the same
family
sort of
style.
Information, family style. But he had his own separate awning, which was never a good thing because even if he was playing the ball straight, you automatically assume he wasn't. But that's another story, that definitely.
Anyway, Satnav says he's been talking to Giancarlo Falappa. What have you been talking to Giancarlo Falappa about?
It'll be going to Arrest or somewhere.
No, that's Gary.
What's
goes
Nat
to
man
Arrest.
Having to say here?
He's talking to Falappa, he says.
Nat. Says intimidated power sounds great. Yeah. They are brilliant. I think that's definitely the way to go. No Limits are producing a new series for this year,
which is naked,
like a Street Fighter class. It's a little bit unclear at the minute exactly what they're letting in.
Well, we've read the rules and we still don't understand it.
Yeah, the rules are a bit sort of grey. They're showing the type of bikes like the MT09, the 765 Triumph, the MT07, which won't stand the chance. and sort of all the naked the
in it as well
yeah
though.
Suzuki GSF 750, the 800 Brutale MV, which looks really nice, but I probably won't get to the end of every race. But then they said in the rules, when you start reading the rules, they mention sports bikes. Now, you either have a naked bike or a sports bike. So what are the sports bike? There's no mention of what the sports bike is. So I'm suggesting the sports bike are things like, GSXR 750s with a handlebar conversion on. And to me, that's going to be the way to go. Because you're straight away you're up to 130 horsepower. And the handling of that other bike will be probably better than the Street Fighters are. But we'll see. But that's another class which is quite
Have
interesting for
we
me.
joined the No Limits Racing Club?
Yes, I'm now a member of the No Limits Racing Club, so that'll get me race license eventually, when the
Okay, well
ACU
then
wake
if
up.
we can find a bike that fits in to your specification within the regulations, it might be something you fancy doing, eh?
Yeah, I might do it. Again, it's scratching a budget out. I was going to try and talk one of the manufacturers, like the KTM 890, is one of the bikes which is up there, and that kind of is something which looks interesting. But then again, it's all about budget at the end of the day, isn't
And
it?
it's not just buying the bike, is it's the tyres.
Yes, they say there's racing which is affordable, and then there's cheap racing. There is never cheap racing. There's no such thing. It's a total fallacy, I think, cheap racing. There's cheaper
It's less
racing,
expensive,
less
isn't it?
expensive racing, but racing is, it's a black hole.
Right, Paul first says, imagine, bloke, that you're 21. You're at the top of the gate of your game in BSB. There won't be many of those about, but there you go. Every factory team at world level wants you. Not taking into account contract terms, which would you go to, World Superbike or MotoGP?
MotoGP. It is where everybody looks, I think, as MotoGP is the pinnacle of racing. It probably is at the end of the day. There's not to say that World Superbike, there's some, and there are some fantastic riders in there. And you look at the lap times, and there ain't a whole heap of difference in it lap time wise. It's like when each of the rides each other's bikes, there doesn't seem to be they don't seem much back. So it's a bit weird the way it all kind of works out. And then you've got the tire confab, some people using different tires and so on. Which would I go? I'd definitely go MotoGP. I remember James Ellison many years ago. He was asking us some advice, and he got the opportunity to ride in MotoGP, but it was on a modified R1. They had back then they had a championship where you could ride basically hopped up road bikes with limited sort of modifications. I forget what the Erta bikes or something they call them. They were called something.
Were they claiming rules? People could claim
No.
them for.
And he got the chance, but the bike was never, as long as his arse pointed down, was never going to do anything. But I said, look, that's the way, that's the place to go. You're never going to win on it, so don't go there with a result in mind, but go there to sort of show people what you're about. Because at that level, it's not just your riding ability, it's a package they'd look for. And he did. And then a couple of years later, he got the Tuath 3 ride with Yamaha. I mean, he didn't really, I think, achieve his full potential at that level, because the difference between the front row and the back row is a very small type thing. So you hiccup and you're going to drop two or three rows.
Paul
So
first says there were CRT bikes.
CRT bikes, that's the one, Paul. I knew they
Anyway,
have
is
something
it
like that.
why do the crowds not go to World Superbike anymore? Because you'll still get crowds at MotoGP, big crowds. Now, is that because they're going for the personalities?
They're still not massive crowds. I mean, you go back to the sort of the late 80s, early 90s. You can go to Donington Park and you'd be queuing for hours to get in. It was You didn't get out till midnight.
That's World Superbike. Yeah, but most people rode there on bikes that they could see on the track.
But what I'm saying is, I don't think that relates anymore now. That's my bike out there. They are, yes, but when people got used to go and watch at GP level. You know, nobody's going to ride around in a Honda RS125 or a Honda RS250, and that's what was out there in the
So
day.
that's what I'm saying, is it the exoticness of MotoGP that keeps it a spectacle now
It,
that nobody's buying
it's
bikes?
it's the top, it's the pinnacle, and that's what people want to go and see. They want to go and see your Rossis, they want to go and see Biaggi's, they want to go and see all the top guys there. So that's kind of what they go there
There
for.
are top guys in World Superbike as well, but I'm saying, I wonder why it's different.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Okay.
It's certainly no more. It's no more affordable. I think the
Oh
budgets aren't terribly dissimilar.
no. Right, Satmav says, can people improve and get quicker, or does a mental block come into play? The older you get, my take is, if you're fit and you're fully alert, there should be no boundaries.
It's good theory that I've. Can
Can you
people,
carry on improving?
I think there will come a ceiling with anybody's ability at the end of the day. I think most people operate quite well below what they can achieve because they put in place like a safety margin, which kind of stops them, not stops them, but keeps them safe ultimately. Their parameters are quite restricted, and I think anybody, everybody can improve, but at some point you get to a sort of a peak or a plateau. And realistically, there's people who have the, as it were, the X factor, which can push them on that bit more, perhaps where they're safe or they just kind of they get away with it. The best example is Marc Marquez. If you watch him ride, he is in a permanent state of about to bin it, but for the entire, he never looks really smooth, super smooth. He always looks, I mean, what he gets away with is just unbelievable. And he will kind of win. And to beat him, you've got to do that or do it even
And
more
more.
and more. It's kind of where qualifying is so important. People underestimate the importance of qualifying. You have to be in that sort of the first five riders getting to the first corner, because certainly at that level, all that's going to happen in the field is the field is going to stretch apart. And if you have to pass people in a field which is stretching apart, it's, you know,
But you've
it's
got to
just
go
not going to
faster
happen.
than
You
them.
just got to go faster.
And if you couldn't out qualify them in the first place, you're never going to catch
You're
them
never going to
passing.
catch him. So you have to be with him and then put him under pressure. I mean, what Rossi was particularly good at was putting people under pressure. And I always remember watching him at Donington Park many years ago. And in the, maybe only on the Saturday practice, which is kind of like not really qualifying, he's just kind of out there doing his thing. And he'd look like he'd never been to the circuit before. He'd be riding all over the fucking place and, you know, clipping curbs and, you know, doing really weird stuff. And you think, what's he doing? And what he's actually doing is, if you watch them on when they're doing their thing, they will drive on a part of the circuit which is the size of the Sun newspaper the whole way around. So it's like a thin strip they're on. So if they're all on that line, you're going to have to do something different, be off the line. And if there's a group of riders, you're going to have to be even further off the line to get to where you need to be. So sometimes, if you end up in a situation where you're offline on a curb that you're not normally on, you need to know what it's like, kind of like.
Otherwise, it's a shock.
Otherwise, it's a shock sort of thing, and you've got to get your brain sort of into gear of what it's like there, what the grip's like there, you know, your trajectory points, all these sort of things. So you'd see him, and he's such a thinking rider in that respect.
So he'd use track time to explore what it felt like to be in the wrong
Wrong
place
place, yeah.
in case he needed to be on the wrong place
Yeah.
to get to
It's
the right
fair
place.
enough being in exactly the right place on the track. That's exactly where you should be. But if you can't be there, you've got to be used to being somewhere else, which isn't kind of perfect. And that's what he used to do quite a lot, which is incredible to watch. Really was.
And now he never gets the opportunity to show those skills because everyone just goes flat out.
Well, yeah, I mean, fucking hell, what a absolute bun fight that class is. It's just incredible. And then you know the breed of riders nowadays. I mean, the Paul Espargaros, or
Your
the names,
Vinales, your
yeah.
Mavericks, and
Maverick Viñales, I think he's kind of peaked a little bit, and he had a really bad year last year. last year. So, but there's loads of them chomping at the heels. The Brad Binder, just, I mean, and KTM as well. That they're it's another bike in the field which is kind of doing the business as well. I'm not sure about the Aprilia, whether that's ever going to do it, but it always seems to be not far off the pace. So yeah, tough bikes, tough class.
Does
Right.
anyone remember Ian Emberton?
Nobody will remember Ian Emberton. Ian Emberton, anybody? No.
Alive.
Ian Emberton is a lovely bloke, lives in Leeds, used to race a 125,
He used to tune them as well.
British Championship, and it was involved in the tuning of them. His company was called Fast as Fuck. And he's mad as a box of frogs. And we were having a chat with him last night because he's now into solar panels. And importation of solar panels and that, so you don't know, but it was very refreshing bumping into him. Completely spaced out, mind.
Andy Preston must have been listening to Rossi because he said, yes, of what you described about Rossi at many was on Stoner at Laguna Seca. And he said that he'd ridden over the grate previously in practice.
Yeah, I would imagine he did. And that corner, the what do they call it now?
Corkscrew.
The corkscrew, yeah. When you see it on telly, it looks like a bit of a drop off, but it's much steeper than the mountain. Imagine going down the mountain backwards, but it's much bigger and much kind of much faster. It's really spectacular. You're coming up a hill, the hill crests. It's all a bit bland, difficult to get visual points. And then all of a sudden you just turn off left and you're just turning off like a fucking ski jump. And the bikes are practically airborne until they kind of gather themselves at the bottom because they always look like they're kind of taking the time going down there because you can't do a lot else. And the bikes are almost in free fall and then they kind of gather themselves up at the bottom. So I remember that because he clipped the curb on the inside and then just picked his heels up. And you could see Stoner looking across thinking, what the fuck's he doing? But yes, he'd almost certainly. He pushed himself, probably overextended himself in practice, maybe, and ended up running over the curb. Thought, oh, fucking that wasn't the end of the world, really. And in a situation where it's nip and tuck, it kind of worked at the end of the day.
Yeah, love that in the overtaking bank
Yeah,
when you need to get a withdrawal.
and why not?
So Mav says, when you say you have the wrong lines, have they? At many tracks, there has to be more lines at work. No, there's only one line, Mav.
Generally, there is really only one line. Depending on what you're wanting out of the corner and the scenarios you can generate, if you're catching a group of riders, for instance, but there's no realistic way of getting past them before the corner or in the corner, your approach should be quite different. An example is, say, Goddard's at
Can
Donington
we draw
Park.
it?
No, Goddard's at Donington Park. If you're catching a group of riders there, you either do a mega commitment and go up the inside of everybody like that. Stop everybody mid-corner so you don't run wide. So let them bunch it behind you and then get out. But if that's not going to happen, one of the best things to do is almost run past the corner, almost like outbrake yourself and run right out into the track and create a big arc on the assumption nobody's behind you to get underneath you. So that all the group of riders that you've caught are all fucking about with each other. Not going particularly fast around the corner, you've run out in the track, and then you can turn the bike under relatively no pressure, and then start to come back for a super late apex under throttle, and come onto the straight potentially quite a bit higher, on the assumption that you're not too close to them. Because of course, if you are running onto the straight faster than them, you'll probably sometimes have to back off, and of course, you've lost your advantage. So you could say, well, in that situation, that's a different line, but there's line. As it were, the best, fastest line around the track. Tactical line is a very different situation. You know, for instance, last lap, the last few bends on any straight, on any circuit, should I say, is you must go, if there's people really close, you've got to go defensive because you're always going to get somebody who'll try and stick it underneath you. And it's then sometimes the little clever. You can call them dirty tricks or whatever. I've had them done all to me, and I've done them all to other people. Things like the last corner at Pembrey, for instance, Honda, it's a really fast right-hander onto the straight. Now, the finish line is only probably 100 yards from the corner. So realistically, it's difficult to out-drag someone on the run there. So you've got to, if you come out of the corner, you're sitting the bike up, you've got it in the bag. So what you do is you go into the corner super hot, you just arrive, you let people run up behind you and sort of hold them up there. And then what you do is you open the throttle, then shut it and open it again. You just do a little bit, a little off like that. Because everyone, as soon as they see you open the throttle, they go. You then shut off, they go, fuck me, what is he doing? And then that little bit of a gap just pops the slipstream and away you go. And it's a shit thing to do, but that's right.
It's a win.
Another one, which is I've seen people do, and it's a cracker, particularly at the end of a long straight. It's stand up. They think it's either a marshal, a flag out, or you're having a problem. And they just ease off that little bit. Because, of course, if you do sit up like that, you're kind of in the wind slipstream and in the wind, and that's all a bit difficult. But there's lots of things you can do. Practical decisions as opposed to, as it were, the ideal scenario.
And, of course, at Castle Coombe, where don't you want to be on the last lap? On the run for the line?
Castle Coombe, coming out.
I mean.
Oh, Thruxton. Oh, fucking hell, no. Yeah.